other yak babies. Sex, presidents, and sometimes books.
Welcome to Yak Babies, a podcast on the internet sponsored by Pine Cones. They're so piney. My name's Aaron. I'm here with personal pals Dave.
Hey, boys.
Brick.
Hello, boys.
And we have old Irish Nico calling from old Ireland.
Hello, boys.
Hello. Hello, men. Let's say that. Watchmen. That's our topic for today.
Oh, boy.
Wow, what a transition.
Hello, men.
Fellow men, hello. So this is part two of our Watchmen discussion. A couple weeks ago, we had part one, and we mentioned this was a long in the works episode. Breaking in Watchmen. Watchmen, I think, deserves two episodes. There's a lot going on there. Let's talk about.
We should say right now that we're spoiling the ending of the Watchmen if for some reason someone has.
Oh, yeah, totally. So this is Dave has now finished Watchmen, right, Dave?
Mm-hmm.
So we can go full whole hog with spoilers this time. Last time we were trying to be pretty careful about spoilers for the most part. This one we're going to go all out. If you haven't read Watchmen and you want to preserve the experience, definitely go stop this and go read it now or read it sometime. Come back and listen to this whenever you want to. It's worth it to not have that spoiled. Which I think, well, actually, we'll hear what Dave has to say about that. I wonder what his thoughts are on being spoiled on this or not. So Dave, now that you're finished, I want to hear your thoughts on the ending of the story. So we get to hear from you last night about that. What did you think of this whole series?
The ending was really satisfying. Yeah. I didn't really see where it was going. And I somehow managed to avoid all knowledge of where it was going.
It's really impressive.
But yeah, I thought it was really well done. Like the, and sort of the unspoken trolley problem situation that always kind of interests me, and I think that was handled well.
Yeah.
And like I said, for issues 1 through 6, like every storyline continued to interest me pretty equally up through the end.
Yeah. I think around issue 9 and 10, maybe issue 10, it gets a bit more like singular plot focus. Like we kind of like the stories start to cohere pretty closely.
10 is my favorite chapter. That's
is
not
it the
last
one where
chapter.
Which
it's the one where all the pieces kind of come together, and it's just very satisfying. It's when you start to realize, like, you don't really know until the last chapter or the end of the 11th, but the ending is telegraphed from the very beginning of the book, and you just don't see it, and it's there the whole time. There's pieces, and it's laid out very well. And then when you start to say, oh, like where this is going is not where I thought it was going, is pretty great. And then I remember it hit me really hard when I first read it. And it's still pretty satisfying, even knowing it's coming.
Yeah, you're right.
On another read.
A little bit unsatisfying to me that they basically cracked the entire case because Night Owl guesses Ozymandias' password, which I guess is like, I don't know, maybe if you're going to do the apologetics for it, maybe he like wants him to catch it so that then he gets there just in time to not be able to stop his plan. But I don't know, that like that, then that, and then it's like, oh, here's all the evidence, it was Ozymandias the whole time.
Yeah, but it's a really good moment when he does the whole like, I'm secretly the villain thing and this is my villain justification, and then it kind of walks into that. You know, did you really think I'd tell you before it was too late? Which they always say, but then it's still not too late. And it's like, oh, yeah, no, it actually already, it's done.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it subverts that trope, but also uses it at the same time, which is interesting. I don't know how much of that is we're supposed to believe that Adrian wants them to find that, or that it's just narrative convenience to get Night Owl to and Rorschach to Antarctica, because if they didn't have the climax, then it wouldn't work. But that was, I think it was this round for sure. I was like, oh, I'm like, his password not just be Ramses 2. That seems pretty obvious for a guy whose codename is Ozymandias.
Right. And he tries Ramses. I found this. And then he goes and he tries Ramses 2. It's like, oh, got it in the second try. Okay.
Ramses 69 was the third option. It didn't work.
It feels like everything here is so tightly wound, though. It would seem like that would be a pretty severe, I don't know, flaw, I guess, or oversight, or just like, let's just let this be this ridiculously convenient thing.
Yeah. I totally agree with you. And that's why it's hard. That's why I wrestle with that one, because I'm not sure. I want to believe that Alan Moore has everything plotted out because everything else is so carefully structured.
Yeah.
But that and the flaw I noticed this time was why, if the comedian was a undercover operative, essentially, and also Night Owl didn't want people to know that he was a superhero, why would he go to his funeral in public? Like, when they all go to the funeral, I'm like, it's kind of obvious. So if you're, this person's being laid to rest and Dr. Manhattan is there, like visibly blue in a suit, and Ozymandias, the most famous person in the world, and then this like nobody scientist guy who no one knows who it is like, I wonder if he's one of the Minutemen or whatever. Probably so, or the New Crusaders, whatever it was.
Was there what was the crowd like at that funeral? I can't really remember.
It was a bunch of government people, and then Dr. Manhattan, Ozymandias, and Night Owl. But then there's like cops watching it.
Wasn't a big crowd that he could just like lose himself in.
Yeah, because no one knows. Limited group. Yeah, no one knows who Edward Blake is outside of the like spy and superhero community. Yeah. But the cops are watching because they just like picked up on they're investigating his death or whatever. So if you're a detective and you see the most powerful people in the world show up at the funeral and this other guy, and it's who they all are.
Yeah.
So is that a flaw in the book or a flaw in the character?
Maybe could be
a flaw
in the character, but it seems uncharacteristic that someone who wanted to maintain secrecy would go to the funeral of someone who he despised. It's interesting. I know, so I was like, I guess I wouldn't have. What is Dan's game in going to the funeral? It's a small thing, but I definitely noticed it because so much of everything else just like works together so perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
But doesn't he also spend a shitload of his time in his basement, like tinkering with old superhero stuff?
Like, yeah.
Maybe that's part of it. Maybe like he wants to be identified as this and he's still like living in it.
Yeah. There's that scene where the cop comes towards the end and seems to know who he is and he gets really paranoid.
There's also that guy that's like, there's the dude that works on Night Owl stuff down my street. Let's go get him. Remember that? And like the bar or whatever. Right. So I don't think it's not as secret as he maybe
would hope for. Yeah, that's true.
There's a couple things that I don't get in the ending that maybe you can help me with.
Yeah.
One is why did they have Mason killed? The old man.
Why did the gang kill him?
Mm-hmm.
I think, I mean, the plot wise, there's like...
Oh, Hollis Mason?
Yeah.
The original. Yeah.
Because they hear about the prison break, right? And then they know that Night Owl's involved and the gang, like the Knotheads, come up with like, well, there's a guy who lives near us who is used to be Night Owl. Let's go get him. Like it's like a mistaken identity,
so it's
right?
It's not part of Ozymandias's...
I don't think so, no.
Okay. And then my other question, which I think this is probably one that a lot of nerds go back and forth on, is why did Manhattan kill Rorschach?
Yeah, I think this is a key question. The ending is like, what do you think of the ending and what does it make you feel? So, you know, I read it as like suicide by cop, basically, right?
Yeah, the best I could come up with was pity.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't understand. You mean why he kills him or why he kills him instead of like imprisoning him or both, I guess?
Both, I guess. I mean, it's not... I don't think Manhattan actually cares about whether or not...
People live.
Rorschach goes back and tells people the truth or not. He doesn't have a... He makes it pretty clear he doesn't have a stake in that race, you know? So he...
So it feels like they think that nobody would believe Rorschach if he talks about what really happened, so there's no threat there?
But either way, I don't know why Manhattan would care. Because he already said, I'm out. I'm going to another galaxy. Like, this is not my problem. You guys are termites. Like,
yeah.
He's not doing it. So is he doing it because it's the friend of the one human he likes? And that guy clearly just wants to die. I don't know why he kills him instead of just leaving or letting him go.
I mean, it seems like...
And it's like directly in contrast to that lady that the comedian shot.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Remember where like you could have saved this person, you didn't, and then instead he vaporizes.
Rorschach. I read it as like Dave was saying, like the trolley problem, like and that Rorschach would have spoiled it, and it was more worth it to him to just kill Rorschach than to have him be a loose end. But I don't buy that. That's what I think it's set up as.
So
I don't like that.
I agree. I just think if that's what the setup is, Manhattan's the wrong trigger man.
Well, I mean, Manhattan is a sociopath. Like, he's not a human anymore. He's just like, well, you've already killed, you know, 4 million people. Tick, tick, tick. One more doesn't matter. I don't give a shit if it's Rorschach or, you know, she would probably kill Lori or, but Manhattan, you know, he would kill anybody. He doesn't care.
But he exists in multiple timelines. If he was worried about this thing getting off or not getting off or working appropriately, he could do it without... Like he has the ability, if he sticks around, to know how that goes and whether. Like,
I guess have to cynically, then that would mean he had to stick around, and he doesn't want to. He's like, well, I'll just do this, and then fuck these people. I'll just go cruise back to Mars.
Once he decides to go, he's made it clear he doesn't have a stake and or a care in what the results of this are. You know, he thinks Ozymandias' plan is logical.
Mm-hmm.
right, and goes with it, but he doesn't, it doesn't, he's neither in agreement or dissent.
I think
from
he
it, right?
does. He has the same or a similar realization that like Laurie and Dan have, which is that this is ultimately going to be the better situation, or for now at least, because he comes back to the Earth with Laurie because he has that realization that human life is valuable, right? That he's not totally cold.
Yeah, but he could literally make all the nukes disappear.
Yeah, right.
So I mean, like it's not a real solution, right? It's a solution that the humans came up with, and he said, "Fine, go with it." And if that's his logic, then he would also say, "Fine, go with the repercussions of a crazy crackpot laying out the truth and whether or not they believe it." Like if he actually cared about the betterment of humanity, he would just vanish all the nuclear weapons.
I see what you're saying. I think I see it more as if he does that, if he vanishes the nuclear weapons, he has to stay on Earth as God, basically, and constantly police that, so whenever Russia or the US tries to develop nukes again, he has to get rid of them again. Whereas,
but the nukes aren't destroyed. There's just as good of a chance that humanity bands together to fight the aliens as Russia just uses as an opportunity to finish off America. And you don't know the difference, and you're supposed not to. There's no guarantee.
Right, and that's what I want to talk about too. But the ending is like, what do you think happens, basically, or
so, and like Manhattan must know that. So his thing with Rorschach has to be a personal character to character choice, mm-hmm. and not this is for the betterment of the thing. I'm just not sure why he made that choice. Was it out of pity for Rorschach? Was it because he thought it would make Laurie happy to like give her one last, like, he won't fuck it up, like, if you guys are going to go with this and be able to disappear in an anonymity, then I'll help you get that. I don't know why he did it. I don't think it was the trolley problem, even though I do think that was what the
setup
was. I think
I see it as doing it for Laurie, but doing it for like humanity as a in a larger point, like let them figure this out. I'm better this than the other way around, where they're just like definitely doomed. And so if Rorschach is too committed to getting the truth out there in whatever form, better to eliminate him than not. But then the existence of his diary in the New Frontiersman offices, like, is the
right,
the fly in that ointment, right?
That's the one part I didn't like, by the way. Where, and this might be a 2020 reading, because I thought it was really great that the diary got there and they're like, oh yeah, just throw that out. He's saying something about like fluoride turns people into homos, and then just throw, like, that's funny.
Yeah.
Right. And like that whole thing just drops because he's an asshole.
Yeah.
Why?
He finds it again in the last frame.
It's why is that a well for you?
I liked it better when like Rorschach's diary just didn't make it out. The truth didn't get out because his opinions and his whatever was just so toxic that it wasn't considered worthy, right? Even though there was truth in there, it was just mired in shit. And I liked it better that way. And then when they end up finding it anyway because they're desperate for something to print, like, I get it, but it's not as satisfying to me.
I think that you have to kind of read, or I guess I get the strong urge to read all of the kind of the end game plot twists as commentary on these kinds of stories. And so like the way that they get there and it's like, well, it's too late, you know, 4 million people just died because you didn't get here 40 minutes ago, and like all that kind of stuff. And kind of the same way with Rorschach, like, so then like he puts this whole journal together, sends it to the newspaper, and then the newspaper's like, threw it on the crank file. And you know, it kind of punctures all of those moments. But I think then, like, so much, like, he does that so many times that he punctures his own punctures, kind of. So, I don't know. I think he kind of twists back.
Yeah, I think you're right. And there's that, and there's also, you know, the secret identities of Laurie and Dan, right? Where it's, like, very purposely ending on ambiguity, which is great, but it's, like, also it hits the ambiguity with a highlighter between that and the journal coming back, or, you know, or it's like a little too much. But it's okay. It's not bad. It doesn't ruin the ending for me.
Dave, what do you think of that? The journal, sort of that kind of last page.
We still don't know
what's
going to happen with it, right? So, I mean, the guy.
Right.
Yeah, he doesn't actually even find it.
And the guy has what, like a couple, like a column space, or maybe two pages or something to fill, like.
According to this show,
the implication is that,
like, they print it and it starts this entire movement of like Rorschach purists, and it kind of takes Rorschach's craziness and like makes it run wild. And that's what like white supremacists basically, like, instead of the Proud Boys, they're the Rorschachs
actual
in the future. Yeah. So it's
just the paper runs the whole journal.
I think so, right?
Yeah.
It becomes like a right-wing, like, underground text, I think, right? Because the world doesn't know that Ozymandias is responsible for it, but he's off-world in this, like, space prison that Manhattan put him in. It's like that, there's that, what's it called? Like the Anderson Diaries or the Henderson Diaries? It's like a right-wing novel about, like a racist murder spree, basically. Like a race war, essentially. It's like a famous, like, underground right-wing text that, like, white supremacists read as, like, they're like, this is what the future should look like, kind of thing. It's like that. And people read it, and they're like, oh, this is the truth. And they become a reactionary mob because they're inspired by the, like, Rorschach's truth, which is troubling because it's truth, right?
Well, do we know at what point Rorschach's journal cuts off? Like, surely he's not maintaining this journal once they go to Antarctica.
No, he drops it off.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
He's like, makes the last entry and is like, I kind of cleaned up and made it sort of readable, essentially, so that people know what I'm talking about. And he drops it off in the mailbox before he goes.
So for anyone to figure out what actually happened, they would have to really get imaginative anyway.
I mean, he does lay it out, doesn't he? He's like, you know, it's Ozymandias. We're going to stop him. If we don't come back, that's who did it.
Right.
Yeah, but there's not a clear line between that and the space monster.
Right. Well,
his journal's not tracking down anything related to that.
Because
he killed everyone because Ozymandias killed everyone else. He made sure there were no witnesses.
Right.
That's the part of the ending that I didn't buy. Like, I feel like I never buy these things where it's like, I'm going to do this horrible thing for the greater good, you know, and like my plan is going to work out, you know, and it's going to be worth 4 million people and destroying New York to unite the world. And it's like, I mean, clearly that's not going to unite the world because, like, we've seen that happen. Like, you know, we've seen, like, with coronavirus, like, that shit doesn't unite even single countries. Like, right. If there's, you know, an unknown enemy, it doesn't, like, magically unite everybody.
Yeah, and Manhattan comes out and says it, too, right. When Ozymandias is like, yeah, did I do the right thing? And he's like, yeah, it doesn't end.
It's like, there is no ending. Like, nothing ever ends, Adrian, right? But that, I think, Nico, I wonder if that's a product of Cold War writing, too. Because this is written in 1986, so the Berlin Wall still hadn't come down yet. And I wonder if now we have a different perspective on what that might mean versus then, when there was still this, like, two powers thinking. I don't know. Maybe not. Right. But I wonder if that's part of it. So my 2020 reading of this, with the journal thing at the end, my reaction to it was more horror, because I was thinking, oh, yeah, this is the thing that could undo the world and, like, take whatever this, like, temporary peace and turn it back into a state of war is right-wing news outlet needing content to publish. And I was like, Jesus, that's, like, exactly where we are. It's like Twitter has to be filled with content, and so people just, like, post their shit, and all of a sudden QAnon takes off, and people believe it. Now there's parades in Washington of thousands of people because they believe this unhinged conspiracy theory.
Right.
And I was like, so this is, we're literally living in Rorschach's America now.
Yeah, that's dark.
It's like if Rorschach had a Twitter account and was on, like, YouTube Live and was just, like, broadcasting, like, we're fucked.
I mean, to a certain degree, weirdly, like, in the real world, I feel better about QAnon than I do, like, Fox News, because Fox News basically destroyed the fabric of American culture for money, whereas QAnon doesn't seem to be directly making any money. And, you know, for all I know, like, potentially believes in this weird bullshit, but Fox, like, clearly doesn't. They just spit out.
Yeah, I'm not sure they're separate entities, but
I know, I think they are, because there's at the rally yesterday, they were talking about how, like, one of the speakers was, now we're going to take apart the GOP because they didn't stop this, and, like, now Fox News is, like, one of the enemy publications. Now it's like, well, Fox News is too liberal. It's like,
right,
what the fuck is going on?
Yeah,
but they benefit from that financially. That just gives them more shit to complain about.
Yeah, but if all of a sudden their core audience starts going to OAN and Newsmax, because that's where their conspiracy theory is more nurtured.
Right.
Yeah, but that's solved with a merger in 2023. Like that, you know, it's like, all as long as they're stirring up the thing that creates their content.
All I mean is that it disturbs me more that I see Fox as just a profit machine, and, like, they just an immoral profit machine. It's like, oh, so there's a big audience for people just to to hear these lies that we say. It's like, great, we'll just do that instead of, you know, any kind of responsible journalism. And it worked. And that to me is worse than the kind of ideologue that stirs up shit because they believe that shit should be stirred or whatever.
I guess maybe the difference between like Ozymandias and Rorschach, where Ozymandias is like fabricating a situation because he thinks it's for the right purposes and like he wants something out of it, which is world peace, and he also wants to be
right.
a world beater. Whereas Rorschach really believes those conspiracies, and that's his life is devoted right. to being like a right wing lunatic.
Yeah. And I mean, it would be really underlined if Ozymandias was just like, yeah, I'm going to be super rich, guys. I he did all these stock moves, right. you know, and he's been analyzing the stock market according to like disasters for years. And he's like all set up financially to take perfect advantage of dropping a squid on New York. And if he was just like, yeah, you know, I don't know, maybe it'll bring people together.
He kind of is that way in the thing between chapters.
Yeah. Yeah, that interview.
It's a cynical fucking book.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah. That's one of my questions I want to ask you too is like, this is not a very hopeful text. And a lot of the criticism of Watchmen, especially in like the past maybe like 15 years or so, has been about like Grant Morrison's almost his entire career has been in some ways a response to this kind of cynicism of Watchmen. It's like, you don't have to be cynical. You can be like that book I made you read, Brick, All-Star Superman, is like the anti-Watchmen, right? It's like, no, like heroes do exist. Hope is real. And I was thinking about this in Watchmen, think about our conversation about Superman over the past several years, and that Watchmen, I think in some ways is the clearest expression of what I think is Brick and Nico's attitude about Superman, which is like, yeah, if there was a character with ultimate power, they would use that power in a way that wouldn't benefit people necessarily. Like Dr. Manhattan is the ultimate Superman.
He is Superman.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the criticism of Watchmen is tends to come on lines of not formal lines, but more like, we don't need this story, right? Or what's kind of the question I started asking last episode, which was, is the structural trickery and the like bravura performance enough, or do you want a different message from this text? And I don't know. It's an interesting question.
I like this book the way it is. What I don't want is more of them.
That's the problem.
You know what I mean? So like, yeah. So that's always the problem with books like this is then suddenly there's 35 copycats. And that's a different kind of cynicism, right? It's like a cynical cynicism as opposed to a critical one or whatever. You know, so to answer your original question, because I punted it on the first one, it's the way that you can get to chapter 12 and then flip back. And because like when you see those people drawing the diagram of the squid, you're like, what the fuck is that? And then you just move on and forget about it. And then it shows up in the ground a little later, you know, and there's other things that are laid out throughout. And it's fun to kind of do that like Usual Suspects thing where you drop the coffee
cup. Or reading through like on your like, I don't know, third or fourth read or whatever, paying really close attention to the Black Freighter and reading that story and picking up on the parallels to the Ozymandias story and how that character is Ozymandias. And like you learn like Alan Moore's true feelings about Ozymandias' plan come out in that comic where it's like Ozymandias is damned. He's like going to go and join the Black Freighter, become this like zombie pirate because he's like a demon essentially. And like his good intentions to save the world cause him to murder everyone. Once that clicks, you're like, fuck, this book has got so much going on. Like it's just like, what a...
Pretty weird.
And like very few comics have that. But Brick, you're totally right. The problem with Watchmen is that it infected comics for going on 30 years now.
That was his beef after this came out, right? It's like after this, everything, it seemed like everyone felt like they had to write comics that were like this, that were like dark and gritty and cynical.
Yeah, that the lessons learned weren't about formal trickery and like structure and careful writing, but instead about content. And if you make your characters violent and grim, and if you allow for like a zero morality world, then you have the same thing. And it's like, that's not true, or it doesn't have to be the case. But yeah, so much the wrong lesson was learned, and that's what bummed Moore out. And what Graham Morrison's problem is, I think, is that like that's the wrong lesson about comics too. It's not a single narrative.
What's the right lesson?
Well, I guess the right lesson would be a really good writer. Like if you I listened to a lecture by this writer Kieran Gillen, who we know, he wrote Die and Phonogram. Yes, I know, everyone hates Phonogram except for me.
I don't remember it, it just funny that you do.
Well, yeah. So that was like one of our first episodes from the page count. It was like at this point, like 6 years ago. And I still remember being made fun of for it. Longer than 6 years, like probably 8 years. So one of his, or he did a lecture on Watchmen. It's like his favorite comic. And he started explaining like his thoughts on it. And his take is that Watchmen isn't like what Alan Moore does in Watchmen seems like a magic trick, but it's actually not, right? All it is just really careful writing and being really good at your craft. And if you really focus and pay attention and work hard, you can do Watchmen too. Like, it's not impossible. And that's, I guess, the lesson of like good fiction in general. Like, you can be, Malcolm Lowry is not God. He's not Dr. Manhattan. He's just Malcolm Lowry, but he wrote this amazing novel, and you could too if you really wanted to.
Right. Well, I guess I would say that the lesson for writers is that, you know, your story window is important, you know, and like Alan Moore put in like so much work to flesh out this whole history of superheroes in this world. Like, so they have 30 years of history before this like 2 week period when the story takes place.
Right.
As opposed to like Saga, for right. instance, that is just like, we're just going to follow their every move, no matter how uninteresting it is. And we're not going to pick a story window. We're just going to, it's like a TV show that gets an unexpected like fifth season. It's like, oh, we don't have any idea what to do. We don't have any stories to tell, but we're going to keep going because right. it pays well. That seems to be the enemy of like a nice, tightly written book.
Aaron, you mentioning Lowry seems like more just kind of like Lowry, because I reread Under the Volcano again after we group did it. Moore was willing to write something that would be a lot more enriching on subsequent reads. And, you know, you obviously can't count on a reader to want to reread something like this with this much investment. But I went back and I looked at the first issue this morning after I finished the whole thing. And it was like, fuck, yeah, that's like all this stuff that I would never have picked up on a first read in the artwork and in the story itself.
Yeah, totally. I recommend, if you can, there's some online for sure. Maybe the whole thing online. And then the annotated Watchmen that I read for this go around, the excerpts from Alan Moore's scripts that he sent to Dave Gibbons are so good. There's like pages long descriptions of single panels. I mean, he just gets into so much detail. There's so much going on. It's almost like reading the book in a third way, like a third, like it's not just annotations. It's like reading the code behind the program in some way. It's really fascinating.
Yeah.
The amount of thought and research and just like esoteric nerd shit he put into it. They're also really funny. Like, there's like really good jokes in the scripts too that like don't, they're not dialogue. They're just like things he's talking about Dave Gibbons about that he likes and wants to like just have a laugh as friends. It's really, they're really cool.
At the back of mine thing, there was these, what is it? I think Dave Gibbons's notes about what like it should look like. Yeah. And there's just like summaries of all the characters and it's, and they're pretty good. It's like Doc Manhattan sees world as subatomic system. Ozymandias sees world as organism with him at center. Night Owl doesn't know how he sees world. Rorschach sees world as immoral and flabby and in need of strict moral code. And the comedian has no interest, has no time or interest for seeing, quote unquote, seeing world. And it's like, yeah, all right.
Yeah, those taking those worldviews, and I add Laurie there, and like Laurie, I don't know, what would you say about Laurie? Not, how would you define Laurie that way? Wants to see the world one way, but has to see the world a different way, potentially? I don't know.
I mean, she kind of gets her entire world flipped upside down when she realizes the comedian is her father.
Right.
It's pretty grim.
Yeah, is living in one world, but has to confront a different one or something like that.
I still hate Dr. Manhattan after that last episode where he like comes in and he's like, okay. And he's like telling Laurie, he's like, yeah, okay. Rorschach says half of New York is dead. And then he's like, oh, Ozymandias is using tachyon beams. Ooh, I don't know what's happening. Ooh, I forgot how weird it is to not know what's happening. And he gets all excited about that. And it's like, you fucking asshole. And yeah. Laurie's like, wait, what? Half of New York is dead.
Yeah.
It's like such a good contradiction.
Yeah, even in his heroic turn, he's still like totally cold and alien and like does not know how to connect to human tragedy at all.
Yeah, it almost seems like he just, like, it's not that he doesn't have feelings anymore. He just doesn't care about people. So he doesn't have any feelings for people. But he still has like those selfish feelings. It's like, ooh, oh, look at this little treat.
Yeah, it seems like the conclusion to his revelation on Mars that like the subatomic miracle of human existence, right? And like he's like, yo, yeah, Laurie is like, I like her. I'm glad she's happy. She's happy with this guy. Like, he doesn't really care about humanity, but he's like, well, at least this is like something nice.
I think he does care. He cares for her.
Yeah, yeah, clearly. But almost, it almost kind of feels like in the way that a scientist might really care for a specimen, right? Or an experiment. Whereas like, I want my experiment to work. And I'm like, you know, scientists like give their equipment like names and shit like that. It almost kind of feels like that, where he's like, I really want this to be happy, but also I don't know what love is.
Yeah. It almost seems like he sees her as like a pet.
Right.
You know, and it's like, yeah, I like her. I have a fondness for her, but we're not equals. Right. We're not like, well, you know.
He leaves her without saying goodbye, obviously. Like, he's not, he goes to a different galaxy.
Right.
And creates life.
Yeah.
One final thought that I have that I just wanted to, it's not even much, just about something I had texted Dave about that I wanted to share with the rest of you too, is I was thinking about our last discussion, and Dave and I both zeroed in on the issue about Dr. Manhattan as being our favorite from the first six. Probably still my favorite of the whole series too. I really love that issue. And it's the most Stuart Dybbuk of all the Watchmen issues. It's like about like nostalgia and sort of being here and there at the same time. And I was like, oh yeah, perfect. Our podcast is so infected with Stuart Dybbuk that even Dr. Manhattan has a bit of Stuart Dybbuk about him too. I thought that was interesting.
What was that, episode 9?
Oh, I think it's like 4 or 5. It's when he...
Yeah, it's pretty early on.
Yeah, it's when he leaves Earth and goes to Mars the first time.
Oh, yeah. I really like 9.
I do too.
When Lori goes to Mars with him and, like, he makes that palace and then, like... Because he's kind of... I like that way of kind of explaining his thought process. He's like, okay, so you're Earth and you have, like, Mount Everest. And here on Mars, there are mountains that are 5 miles high. They're like, or whatever, 50 miles high. They're like 10 times the size of Everest. And there are these trenches that are, you know, hundreds of miles deep or whatever. And just that kind of scale of conception, it's like, and he's like, it's not your fault. It's just, you're not as impressive as Mars. So that's where I'm going to be.
Yeah, just like prime asshole shit.
Yeah.
Last thoughts or anything else you want to wrap up on?
I'm definitely going to read this again. I'm really happy that we did this. I can't envision a scenario where I would have just randomly read this, and I really liked it. And, you know, just reading issue 1 again made me want to read through the whole thing. I don't think I'll do that now. I'll maybe give it some time, but I'm definitely going to visit this again.
Yeah.
It's a very good book.
Yeah, yeah. Strongly recommend those annotations. I'm going to try and get my hands on the Absolute Watchmen too. It's a big, like, oversized edition, and it has a bunch of stuff in it. I would like to get that just to study it some more. I actually don't own it, so I need to own my own copy, and that'd be a good one, I think, to have on hand.
Aaron, how meaningful is this book to you? Is this, like, one of your favorites of your life?
Yeah, it's funny, because, like, coming into this read, I was looking forward to it, because I hadn't read it in a while, but also I was aware of, I guess I'm much more a Grant Morrison person, where like, yeah, I want the hope, I want the good part of Superman, right? But I still, I mean, I read it as a kid, I loved it. It's always been one of those like canonical texts that you, not that you have to love, but it's like, it's so built up, right? And even the first time I read it, I still knew enough going into it that this is an important book to be reading, whatever, at this time.
The appropriate follow-up question is canon or canon?
Oh, yeah. That's actually a good, yeah, that's a really good question, because people do teach Watchmen in schools or in classes now, and some of these literature classes are mostly just like in different kind of media classes. I mean, 100% canon for me, for sure. This has
to be. What do you mean now? Like, only recently that became a thing? Or?
Yeah, I would say, I don't know, maybe the past 20 years or so, comics are more commonly accepted as literature in programs like that, and by the institution or by academia at least. But I even like did a presentation like a part of a chapter of a book about teaching with comics, and my qualm was like, don't just teach Watchmen, right? Like, Watchmen's so good for sure, but there's millions of other comics to talk about too, and like those comics are also literature and deserving of critique and focus, like we would too. Like, you know, don't just read the classics. But it is a fucking classic. Like, it's so good. I mean, this read just confirmed how fucking good it is.
Yeah. Brick, now that we've done this, are you clear on the Alan Moore, Grant Morrison distinction? No, still not.
No. No.
Is it because Morrison came up too in this podcast that threw you off? Just still fucked.
Honestly, it's because their names sound the same. That's really it.
Alan Moore is a very hairy man. He's got like long hair and a long beard, and Grant Morrison's like bald.
Doesn't help me.
Nico, what were you saying?
Oh, I was going to say that I think it should be in the canon, but unfortunately for the greater good, we have to destroy every copy of it, fire it into the sun.
We'll send one copy to fucking QAnon.
Shove it up a squid.
Yeah, don't ask questions. Also, I had one other random thought about that at issue 9, it seemed to me kind of like the way that's also the, so this is the issue where it's a Dr. Manhattan issue and Laurie is on Mars with them and she kind of figures it out about the comedian and like can't help but keep thinking about all those lines that were evidence of, and she's like, and she's kind of reduced to tears from and rage from being traumatized by all of that, those memories that she can't control. And it kind of seems similar to me as the to the way that Dr. Manhattan is constantly like remembering other times and like future times and past times. And so it was like, I wonder if there's, if part of that link is like he's being traumatized by knowing everything at the same time, and like that's part of what makes him just kind of emotionally no longer human.
Yeah, no, I think you're totally right about that. Like if you could see your entire timeline and the timelines of everyone around you that you knew or cared about, like you wouldn't be a very happy person probably. And if you felt like you had a responsibility to not just interfere with it all, if you were like, I can't just I can't just change the world, I have to let my loved ones die in these ways knowing that I can't do anything about it, like that would, yeah, would fuck you up severely. I just thought of one more thing. maybe a quick one. I don't know. We need to wrap this episode up. Talk about endings. The other ending that I think is also worth discussion and maybe worth its own separate issue or episode potentially, as there's so much to unpack there, is when Sally Jupiter kisses the picture of the comedian at the end. Like that ending is so hard. And I don't know. That's the more controversial one, I think, in some ways.
I don't like that part.
Yeah, tell us more.
I don't want to. It doesn't. Well, there's also, she makes a comment about they had one day together in a summer.
Yeah.
So up until that point, I thought that she was impregnated. There was more to that scene than we saw.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah, no, I think it's make it clear that, so then it's not clear if that scene was before or after the assault that we did see.
Right.
But either way, I don't like it.
It's rough, yeah.
Yeah, it's. I think that comes from a 1980s kind of masculine worldview that we've moved beyond.
Yeah,
I don't think there's definitely like intended to be trauma and hurt in there, but I don't think we read that now how it was intended to be read, which is as a sort of morally ambiguous.
100%. You're totally right. That's what Moore's going for, and I don't think if you did a feminist reading of that, it wouldn't be the same. You wouldn't have the same outcomes from that for sure. It's a much different ending and much darker in that way. Listeners, your thoughts on Watchmen, let us know. Now we've revealed all. You've been spoiled. Hope you read it for yourself before that. Talk to us on Twitter and let us know what your thoughts are on this seminal text of graphic literature. Just literature period, actually. Let's call it graphic literature. On Twitter, YakBabies, and also email us at yakbabiespodcast@gmail.com. We can be found there. And then if you want more Yak Babies content, go to patreon.com/yakbabies. And for $1 a month, you can get access to our bonus podcast, which has all of our secret episodes. There's games, there's Broto Bros. There's going to be a lot of content from this recording session today on that. You're missing out if you don't do that. So for $1, go access all that stuff. It's voluntary blackmail. So let us be blackmailed by you for that $1. Until then, Yak Babies, yakking off.
The Yak Babies would like to thank all the loyal listeners, and especially their patrons past and present, including Michael, Bonnie, Sebastian, David, Roger, and William Howard Taft.